The Duke of Blackwood, Alistair Beaumont, regarded the men seated around the polished expanse of his boardroom table as one might regard a set of well-made, if entirely predictable, chess pieces. There was Mr. Harding, his solicitor, a rook of unwavering loyalty and straight-lined thinking. There were the trustees, interchangeable bishops and knights, moving in their prescribed patterns of finance and land acquisition. Alistair was the king, of course, a king whose position, for all its power, was perilously close to a state of check. The Beaumont line required an heir. Urgently, Harding cleared his throat, the sound a dry rustle of parchment. "And so, Your Grace, with the final codicil regarding the Dowager's pin money settled, the marriage contract with the Vance family is complete. Miss Eleanor Vance will become your duchess in a fortnight." A murmur of satisfaction went around the table. An alliance with the Vances, though they were of modest means, brought with it a lineage as old and unblemished as any in England. It was a sound move, a logical move. It was, in Alistair's estimation, the final column in a long and tedious ledger of ducal responsibility. One of the trustees, a portly baronet named Sir Giles, offered a placating smile. "An excellent choice, Your Grace. Miss Vance is well regarded." "A quiet sort of girl, I hear. Biddable." Alistair picked up a silver letter opener, turning it over in his long fingers. The metal was cold and definite. He preferred things that were cold and definite. "Her temperament is of little consequence," he stated, his voice as cool and polished as the silver in his hand. "She is of good health, good breeding, and possesses a name that will not cause embarrassment when engraved on the nursery silver. The arrangement is a practical one." He paused, his gaze sweeping over the expectant faces. He felt a sudden, sharp need to draw a line under the entire affair, to categorize it, and put it away. "I have no use for her opinion," he said, the words dropping into the quiet room with the finality of a gavel. "Only her compliance and an honorable name to pass to my son." The board, which had been waiting for just such a definitive pronouncement, collectively relaxed. This was the Duke they knew. Decisive. Unsentimental. A man who managed his duchy and his life with the same dispassionate efficiency. The business of the succession was settled. They could now move on to the far more interesting topic of mineral rights in the north. Eleanor Vance first met her future husband in the stifling formality of her father's study. The room smelled of aging leather and fading hopes, a scent she had known all her life. The Duke of Blackwood stood by the window, a tall, severe silhouette against the weak afternoon light. He was handsome in a way that was more architectural than human, all sharp angles and imposing structure. He looked less like a man and more like a monument to his own lineage. He turned as she entered, his gray eyes assessing her with an unnerving lack of interest. It was the look a man might give a horse he was considering for purchase, checking the teeth, the fetlocks, the general soundness of the beast. She was, she knew, an unremarkable creature. Her hair was a simple brown, her eyes a quiet hazel, her figure neat but unremarkable. She was not the sort of woman who turned heads or inspired poetry. She was the sort of woman who catalogued books and ensured her father's accounts were in order. Her competence, a quiet, invisible thread holding their fraying household together. "Miss Vance," he said. It was not a question, but a confirmation. "Your Grace," she replied, her voice steady. She had practiced it. She had practiced being steady. Their conversation was a masterpiece of polite nothingness. He spoke of the weather. She agreed it was temperate for the season. He inquired after her family's health. She assured him they were well. It was a transaction coated in the thinnest veneer of social grace. He was purchasing a womb and a name. She was selling them for the security of her family. There was no need to pretend otherwise, and to her relief, he did not. His detachment was a strange sort of courtesy. It was honest. And yet, as he was about to depart, his gaze fell upon a small leather-bound volume on a side table. It was a treatise on crop rotation, a rather dense and technical work she had been studying. "An unusual choice of reading for a young lady," he remarked, his tone holding the faintest hint of something that might have been curiosity, or perhaps just surprise at finding an anomaly in an otherwise predictable environment. "I find agriculture a more compelling subject than romance novels, Your Grace," Eleanor said, a sliver of her true self showing through. "One deals in predictable yields and logical outcomes. The other," she added, with a ghost of a smile, "seems to rely on a great deal of improbable fortune." For the first time, the Duke of Blackwood truly looked at her. A flicker of something surprise, recalibration passed through his cool gray eyes. He had expected a blank page, a simple, unwritten slate. He had found, it seemed, a line of finely scripted text where none was supposed to be. He registered the observation, filed it away as an insignificant detail, and then dismissed it. It did not alter the terms of the contract. It did not change the fundamental nature of the arrangement. He had not acquired her for her thoughts on agriculture. He had acquired her for her compliance. He gave a stiff, formal bow. "I shall see you at the altar, Miss Vance." And then he was gone, leaving behind only the faint scent of expensive wool and the cold certainty of her future. She was to be the Duchess of Blackwood. A title. A function. An object, polished and placed just so, in the grand, cold house of his life. She understood the terms perfectly. The wedding was a grand, impersonal affair, a pageant of ducal power. Eleanor moved through it as if in a dream, her white satin gown a suit of armor, her veil a merciful shroud. She made her vows in a clear, quiet voice, and when the Duke slid the heavy gold band onto her finger, its cold weight felt less like a symbol of union and more like the final click of a lock. Her new home, Blackwood Manor, was much like its master, magnificent, imposing, and utterly devoid of warmth. It was a museum of a house, filled with priceless art and centuries of history, but it felt less like a home and more like a mausoleum for the Beaumont legacy. The staff were efficient, the rooms were immaculate, and the silence was profound. Alistair had been clear about his expectations. They would dine together each evening. They would appear together at necessary social functions. They would produce an heir. Beyond that, their lives were to be their own. He had his duties, his clubs, his world. She was free to occupy herself with whatever trivialities duchesses concerned themselves with. He assumed this meant needlepoint or managing the flower arrangements. The discovery happened on a Tuesday, 3 weeks into the marriage. It was an accident of misplaced paperwork. Mr. Harding had been to the manor to consult with the Duke, and in his haste to depart, he had left a leather portfolio on the marquetry table in the morning room. Eleanor, seeing it, intended to have a footman take it to the solicitor's office in the village, but the clasp was undone, and a sheaf of papers had slid partially out. One, folded crisply, bore her new title. Regarding the Duchess, curiosity was not a vice she typically indulged, but the starkness of the heading pulled at her. She thought it might be some settlement detail, something she ought to know. Her fingers, acting of their own accord, slipped the letter from its fellows. It was a copy of a correspondence from the Duke to his solicitor, dated a week before their engagement was finalized. She read it standing there, the cool morning light from the tall windows illuminating the Duke's sharp, decisive script. The letter was a clinical assessment of her suitability. It listed her attributes as one might list the features of a property, of sound constitution, lineage impeccable, disposition, noted as placid and retiring, which is to be preferred. It was the final paragraph that stopped her breath. "Harding, you will finalize the terms as we discussed. She meets all necessary criteria and will not, I trust, prove to be a complication. Her thoughts on the matter are irrelevant, and I expect her presence in the house to be as unobtrusive as her presence in society has been heretofore. I have no use for her opinion, only her compliance and an honorable name to pass to my son. See it done." The paper did not tremble in her hand. A storm did not break within her. There was no great, shattering grief. Instead, there was a profound and terrifying clarity, as if a pane of flawed glass through which she had been viewing her life had suddenly been replaced with one of perfect, merciless transparency. She had known the marriage was a transaction. She was not a fool. But she had allowed herself a small, secret hope that it might, in time, become something more. That respect might grow, that a quiet companionship might blossom in the sterile halls of Blackwood Manor. She had thought, perhaps, he might one day come to see her, the woman who read treatises on agriculture, who understood logistics better than his own estate manager, who found solace in the complex mathematics of a Bach fugue. But the letter told her the truth. He had no interest in seeing her. He had, in fact, chosen her precisely because he believed there was nothing to see. He had not married a woman. He had filled a vacancy. Very carefully, with fingers that were suddenly cold, Eleanor folded the letter along its original creases. She slipped it back into the portfolio, tucking it deep within the other documents. She closed the clasp. A click. It sounded like a door shutting, very far away. She rang the bell for the footman and instructed him to deliver the solicitor's portfolio. Her voice was perfectly calm. Her expression was perfectly serene. But inside, a light had gone out. The small, hopeful flame she had nurtured in the secret corners of her heart had been extinguished as easily and as thoughtlessly as snuffing a candle. From that moment on, she became the perfect Duchess of Blackwood. She was exactly what he had wanted. She was a ghost in her own home. Alistair began to notice it not as a single event, but as a slow accumulation of absences. He had wanted an unobtrusive wife, and he had gotten one, with a vengeance. The problem was, unobtrusive was beginning to feel a great deal like unnerving. It started at the dinner table. Their meals, once punctuated by Eleanor's quiet but intelligent observations about the news of the day or a book she was reading, became silent affairs. She answered his questions politely, concisely, and without an ounce of inflection. Her smile was a perfect, beautiful, and utterly empty curve of her lips. It never reached her eyes. Her eyes were like calm, still pools of water, reflecting the surface of things but revealing nothing of the depths beneath. He would ask, "How did you spend your day, Eleanor?" And she would reply, pleasantly, "Thank you, Your Grace. I attended to some correspondence." No mention of the correspondence's subject. No amusing anecdote about a misaddressed letter, nothing. Just the fact, delivered as smoothly and coldly as a piece of polished stone. Then he noticed the silence of the house itself. Blackwood Manor had never been a boisterous place, but now, a funereal quiet seemed to have settled over it. He realized one afternoon that he hadn't heard the sound of the pianoforte in weeks. He'd learned from her father that she was a gifted musician, and in the first days of their marriage, the faint, elegant strains of Bach or Scarlatti had often drifted from the music room. Now, the room was a tomb. The lid of the grand piano was always down, its polished surface reflecting the empty room like a black mirror. He was present, and she was absent. She was there, and she was not there. He found himself looking for her. A strange and irritating compulsion. He would walk into the library, a vast two-story chamber that was his personal sanctuary, and feel a sense of disappointment. He would realize, with a jolt, that he had been half expecting to find her curled in one of the wingback chairs by the fire, a book in her lap. In the early days, she had often been there, and he had found her quiet presence surprisingly calming. Now, the chair was always empty. The library was just a room full of books again, and it felt hollow. One evening, driven by a frustration he could not name, he sought her out after their silent dinner. He found her in the drawing room, engaged in the one activity he found truly mind-numbingly tedious. Needlepoint. Her head was bent over a frame, her fingers moving with a swift, mechanical precision. "Eleanor," he began, his voice sounding too loud in the quiet room. She looked up, her expression one of placid inquiry. "Your Grace?" "I find I am at a loss this evening," he said, the words feeling clumsy and foreign in his mouth. I thought perhaps a game of chess. He had discovered during their brief courtship that she played an excellent game. Her strategy was unconventional, patient, and often devastatingly effective. Their first few games had been a genuine challenge, a clash of intellects he had found surprisingly stimulating. A faint, polite smile touched her lips. "I am afraid I am not a suitable opponent for you, Your Grace. My skills are rudimentary at best." "You would find the game quite dull." He stared at her. This was patently untrue. She had beaten him twice. "Nonsense," he said, a touch more sharply than he intended. "You play a formidable game. You are too kind," she demurred, her gaze dropping back to her needlework. "But I fear my mind is not inclined toward strategy this evening. I would only prove a disappointment." It was a dismissal. A perfect, polite, unassailable dismissal. She was refusing him, but she was doing it in such a way that to press the point would make him seem a bully. He was the Duke of Blackwood. He was not accustomed to being managed. He was certainly not accustomed to being managed by his quiet, biddable wife. He stood there for a moment, feeling an unfamiliar sense of helplessness. The woman before him was a stranger. She wore his wife's face, spoke with his wife's voice, but the person he had caught glimpses of, the intelligent, witty woman who read about crop rotation and played a killer's game of chess, was gone. In her place was this automaton, this perfect porcelain duchess, who was polite, compliant, and utterly, maddeningly vacant. He had gotten exactly what he said he wanted, and it was intolerable. The weeks turned into 2 months, and the chill in the house deepened. Alistair found his own efficiency fraying at the edges. His concentration at board meetings was fractured. He would find himself staring out the window, not at the sprawling lands of his duchy, but at an image of an empty chair in his library. He had built his life on a foundation of logic and control, and a quiet, hazel-eyed woman was dismantling it brick by brick with the simple, devastating weapon of her absence. The breaking point came in the form of a conversation with Mr. Harding. The solicitor had come to the manor to review the quarterly accounts, a task they usually performed with brisk efficiency in the Duke's study. "The investments in the shipping concern have performed admirably, Your Grace," Harding said, tapping a line in the ledger. "A return of 12%. "Good," Alistair said, his voice flat. He was looking at a vase on the mantelpiece. Eleanor had replaced the stiff, formal arrangements of the previous housekeeper with simple branches of autumn leaves. It was an improvement. It was the only sign of her taste, her preference, he could identify in the entire house. Harding paused, his pen hovering over the page. He was a perceptive man, and he had served the Beaumonts for 40 years. He had seen Alistair grow from a serious boy into a severe man. He had never seen him so distracted. "Is everything to your satisfaction, Your Grace?" Harding asked, his tone carefully neutral. "Regarding the household?" Alistair finally looked at him, his gray eyes stormy. "The household runs with the precision of a Swiss watch," he snapped. "My wife is a paragon of domestic management. The meals are on time, the linens are starched, and the staff is terrified into perfect submission. It is a model of efficiency." He stood up and walked to the window, his back to the solicitor. "It is also as cheerful as a crypt." Harding chose his next words with the care of a man defusing a bomb. "The Duchess seems subdued, I will grant. When I first met her, I was struck by her wit, a very sharp mind." "Her mind?" Alistair laughed, a short, bitter sound. "I have more stimulating conversations with my horse. She speaks only when spoken to, and then only in the most banal of pleasantries. The woman has no opinions, no passions, no thoughts of her own whatsoever." There was a long silence. Harding slowly capped his ink bottle. He set his pen down with deliberate care. "With respect, Your Grace," he said, his voice quiet but firm, "that has not been my experience of her." Alistair turned from the window. "What do you mean?" "Last month, when you were in London, there was a dispute over the water rights for the tenant farms at West Creek," Harding explained. Your estate manager, Mr. Finch, was prepared to take the tenants to court. It would have been costly, and the outcome uncertain. He paused. The Duchess happened to overhear Finch discussing the matter. She asked to see the original deeds and the ordnance survey maps. She spent 2 days in the records office. Alistair stared at him, a cold knot forming in his stomach. He had not heard a word of this. She found a precedent. Harding continued. In a property boundary agreement from 1783, a forgotten right-of-way, she drafted a compromise, a brilliant one, that satisfied the tenants and actually improved the irrigation for the home farm. She solved, in 2 days, a problem that has plagued this estate for 50 years. She asked only that her involvement not be mentioned to you. S. The room seemed to tilt. Alistair gripped the back of a chair to steady himself. A woman with no thoughts of her own. A woman with no mind for strategy. Why? Alistair asked, the word a raw whisper. Why would she not want me to know? Harding met his gaze, and for the first time, Alistair saw not a solicitor, but a man who knew him, and who perhaps pitied him. Perhaps. Harding said gently, She has formed the impression that you have no use for her opinion. The words, I have no use for her opinion. The phrase struck him with the physical force of a blow. He remembered saying it. He remembered the cold finality of it, the dismissive arrogance. He remembered the faces of the board members, nodding in approval of his decisive command. And he remembered Harding, standing there, his expression unreadable. The letter. The realization crashed over him, a wave of ice and fire, the misplaced portfolio, the timing, the abrupt, seismic shift in his wife's demeanor, from a person into a porcelain shell. It all aligned with a horrifying, sickening precision. She knew. She had read the letter. He felt a profound, gut-wrenching shame, so intense it made him physically dizzy. He had not merely insulted her. He had passed a death sentence on her spirit, and she, in her quiet, devastating way, had chosen to carry it out. She had given him exactly what he had demanded, a duchess of perfect compliance, utterly devoid of the very qualities he now found himself desperately missing, the wit, the intelligence, the quiet fire. He had extinguished it all with a careless flick of his pen. He thought about the empty chair in the library. He thought about the silent pianoforte. He thought about her brilliant solution to the West Creek dispute, a solution she had hidden from him because she believed he would not value it. He thought about her eyes, those beautiful hazel eyes, once so full of intelligent light, now as vacant as the rooms of his perfectly managed, perfectly silent house. He had been a fool, a blind, arrogant fool. Your Grace? Harding's voice was laced with concern. Alistair waved a dismissive hand, not looking at him. Leave me, Harding. The accounts can wait. After the solicitor had gone, Alistair stood motionless in the center of the room for a very long time. The silence he had once craved now pressed in on him, suffocating him. It was not an absence of sound. It was the presence of a void. It was the sound of a life unlived, a partnership squandered, a woman erased. And he was its sole architect. He had to find her. He did not know what he would say. I am sorry felt like a pebble tossed into a chasm. But he knew, with a certainty that eclipsed all his previous logical conclusions, that he could not endure another day in the tomb he had created. He had to find his wife. He had to find Eleanor. He did not find her in the drawing room with her needlepoint, nor in the morning room with her correspondence. He did not find her in her pristine, impersonal bedchamber. On a desperate impulse, he left the main house and strode across the manicured lawns towards the rear of the estate, where a row of glasshouses stood, relics of a previous duke's botanical passions. Most were in disrepair, but one, the smallest of them, had recently had its broken panes replaced. He had approved the expense without a thought, assuming it was for the head gardener. He pushed open the creaking door and stepped inside. The air was warm and humid, thick with the scent of damp earth and green, growing things. And there she was. She was on her knees before a long planting bench, her back to him. The sleeves of a simple cotton dress were pushed up to her elbows, her hands gloved and dusted with soil. She was carefully tending to a row of small, delicate seedlings. Here, away from the oppressive grandeur of the manor, she looked different, younger, more real. There was a focus in the set of her shoulders, a purpose in the gentle movements of her hands. This was not the vacant Duchess. This was someone else. This was the woman he had married and then immediately lost. He must have made a sound, because she stiffened and slowly rose, turning to face him. Her expression was guarded, the serene mask slipping perfectly into place. But he saw the flicker of surprise in her eyes, the momentary vulnerability of being discovered in her sanctuary. "Your Grace," she said, her voice even. "I did not expect you here." He walked towards her, his boots loud on the stone-flagged floor. He stopped a few feet away, taking in the scene, the ordered rows of plants, the neatly labeled pots, the careful, patient work of her hands. It was a world she had built for herself, a place of quiet, logical growth, hidden away from him. He did not know where to begin. The carefully constructed words he had rehearsed on the walk over crumbled into dust. All that was left was the raw, unvarnished truth. "I was wrong," he said. The words felt rough, torn from his throat. She simply watched him, her hazel eyes unreadable. She did not help him. She did not offer a polite platitude to ease his way. She just waited. "The letter," he said, forcing himself to meet her gaze. "Harding's portfolio. You read it." It was not a question. She gave a small, almost imperceptible nod. Her composure was absolute. It was more damning than any tirade of tears or anger could ever have been. Her stillness was a judgment. "I wrote that," he continued, the words coming faster now, driven by a desperate need to make her understand. "I wrote those things. I believe them. I was an arrogant fool, operating under the delusion that a wife was simply another asset to be managed. I chose you because I thought you were simple, uncomplicated. I did not want a partner. I wanted a placeholder." The shame was a physical thing, hot and heavy in his chest. "I see now. I see what I did. I took a living, breathing person, a woman of intelligence and wit and substance, and I tried to turn you into a ghost. And you, in your quiet way, let me. You gave me exactly what I deserved." He gestured around the glasshouse. "This. The West Creek dispute. The books you read. The music you used to play. I failed to see any of it. I failed to see you. I was blind." He finally ran out of words, his confession hanging in the warm, earthy air between them. He had laid his folly bare. He had admitted his profound, catastrophic error. Eleanor looked at him, and for the first time in months, he saw a flicker of genuine emotion in her eyes. It was not forgiveness. It was a cool, analytical appraisal. She was weighing his words, testing their sincerity. "You are correct, Your Grace," she said, her voice as quiet as ever, but with a new edge of steel beneath it. "You were blind. And I concluded it was not my place to instruct a man on how to see." It was the most honest thing she had said to him in 2 months, and it cut him to the quick. "Let me learn," he said, taking a step closer. "Eleanor, let me learn." She did not step back. She held her ground. "Learning requires a willing student," she observed. "And proof of progress. Words are easily spoken." He knew then that this was not the end of the conversation, but the beginning of a much longer, more difficult one. An apology was not enough. He had to atone, and atonement would not be a single act, but a sustained, deliberate effort to undo the damage he had wrought. His first act of atonement came 3 days later, at a dinner party hosted by the Earl of Sedgwick. Sedgwick was a man whose friendship Alistair had cultivated out of social necessity, but whose shallow wit and casual cruelty he had always privately disdained. The talk had turned to politics, and Eleanor, seated beside Sedgwick, had made a quiet, insightful comment about a new trade bill. Sedgwick, who viewed women as decorative objects, chuckled condescendingly. "My dear Duchess," he said, his voice carrying down the table, You mustn't trouble your pretty head with such dreary matters. Leave that to the men. The table fell quiet. In the past, Alistair would have ignored the comment, letting it pass as the inconsequential drivel it was. But he looked at Eleanor. He saw the flicker of resignation in her eyes, the familiar retreat into her serene shell, and a cold, clear rage settled over him. On the contrary, Sedgwick, Alistair said, his voice cutting through the silence like a shard of ice. My wife's understanding of the bill's economic implications is considerably more nuanced than yours. In fact, she pointed out a flaw in the third clause this morning that my own solicitor missed. Perhaps you should be taking notes. A shocked silence descended. Sedgwick flushed a deep, mottled purple. To be so thoroughly and publicly dressed down by the Duke of Blackwood was a social death sentence. Alistair met Eleanor's gaze across the table. He saw a flicker of astonishment in her eyes, a crack in the porcelain facade. It was a start. He did not expect her to thank him. He did not deserve thanks for performing the most basic duty of a husband. But on the carriage ride home, the silence between them felt different. It was no longer a void, but a space filled with unspoken questions. The rebuilding was a slow, painstaking process. It was a negotiation conducted not in words, but in actions. He began to ask for her opinion, not as a test, but because he genuinely needed it. He brought her the estate ledgers, a silent admission of what he'd learned from Harding. She reviewed them, and her suggestions were incisive, saving him thousands of pounds and improving the tenants' yields. They began to speak of the estate as ours. He went to the music room one afternoon. He opened the pianoforte and left a book of Scarlatti sonatas on the stand, the very ones he had heard her play in the first week of their marriage. He said nothing. He simply left it there. For a week, it remained untouched. Then, one evening, as he sat in the library, he heard it. The faint, hesitant notes, at first, then growing in confidence, filling the silent house with a beauty he had nearly forgotten. He closed his eyes and just listened, a feeling of profound, fragile hope blooming in his chest. He started reading her books. He struggled through the dense texts on botany and economics, not because he was suddenly fascinated by the subjects, but because he was fascinated by the woman who understood them. It gave them something to talk about. Their dinners were no longer silent. They were filled with cautious debate, with the sharing of ideas. He was discovering the woman he had married, layer by fascinating layer. He was discovering her mind, and he found it more captivating than any beautiful face he had ever known. Her reserve did not vanish overnight. It was a fortress, and he had to dismantle it stone by painstaking stone. He earned her smiles, small, genuine things that started in her eyes. He learned the quiet language of her moods, the way she tilted her head when she was considering a problem, the small frown that meant she disagreed but was still formulating her argument. He was learning to see. The final wall crumbled during what became known as the Sedgwick affair. Embittered by his public humiliation, Lord Sedgwick had conspired with a disgruntled former manager of the Blackwood estate to orchestrate a fraudulent claim on a piece of ducal land using forged documents and bribed witnesses. It was a cleverly constructed attack, designed to cause maximum financial and social damage. It was Eleanor who saved them. While Alistair focused on the legal battle, Eleanor focused on the history. She spent weeks in dusty archives, poring over centuries-old maps and letters. She found it in a forgotten diary of a former duchess, a detailed account of a land swap in 1720, with a hand-drawn map that proved Sedgwick's claim was based on a deliberately misidentified parcel. Her research not only exonerated the Blackwood title but exposed Sedgwick's fraud completely. That night, after Harding had left with the evidence that would ruin Sedgwick, Alistair found Eleanor in the library. The fire was roaring, casting a warm glow over the room. She was standing by the window, looking out at the moonlit gardens. He came to stand beside her. For a long time, they were silent, watching the silver light on the leaves. "We make a good team," he said, his voice quiet. She turned to look at him, and the last of her reserve was gone. In her eyes was a warmth and a clarity that he now realized was the most beautiful thing he had ever seen.
"Yes," she said.
"We do." He reached out and took her hand. Her fingers curled around his, a gesture of trust so profound it made his heart ache. "Eleanor," he began, his voice thick with an emotion he no longer tried to hide. "When I married you, I thought I was fulfilling a duty. I was wrong. I was beginning a salvation. Not for my family line, but for myself." He brought her hand to his lips. "I don't just have a use for your opinion. I find I cannot live without it. I cannot live without you. I love you." A single tear traced a path down her cheek, a tear not of sorrow, but of a joy so long suppressed it was almost painful. "And I love you, Alistair," she whispered. The words a gift he knew he would spend the rest of his life trying to deserve. He drew her into his arms, and as he held her, the last of the cold silence of Blackwood Manor vanished forever, replaced by the steady, certain warmth of a love that had been earned. 1 year later, the Duke of Blackwood stood in the doorway of the nursery, a room that was no longer a hypothetical space on a blueprint but a sun-filled reality. It smelled of milk and clean linen and the faint, sweet scent of a baby. In a rocking chair by the window sat Eleanor, his duchess, his wife, his partner. She was not looking at him. Her gaze was fixed on the small bundle in her arms, a son with a fuzz of dark hair and his mother's calm, intelligent eyes. She was humming a soft melody, a simple lullaby, but it was a sound more beautiful to Alistair than any symphony. The house was no longer silent. It was filled with the small, essential noises of a life being lived. The crackle of the fire, the murmur of voices, the cry of a newborn, the sound of music from the pianoforte in the afternoons. Harding had been by that morning, not to discuss ledgers, but to see the heir. The old solicitor had looked from the baby to the Duke, a rare, genuine smile on his face. "He has his mother's eyes, Your Grace," he had said. "He will be a wise man." Alistair watched his wife now, a sense of profound peace settling over him. He thought of the man he had been, the cold, arrogant Duke sitting at the head of a boardroom table, dismissing the woman who would become the center of his world. He had been so certain of what he needed, and so utterly, blindly wrong. He had sought a compliant shadow, and had, by some miracle of grace he did not deserve, found a brilliant, shining light. Eleanor looked up then, as if sensing his presence. She smiled at him, a real smile, one that lit her entire face and made the room seem brighter still. It was a smile of shared joy, of deep and abiding love, of a partnership forged in the crucible of his own foolishness. He had once declared that he had no use for her opinion. Now, he knew the truth. Her opinion was the foundation upon which his new life was built. Her perception was the lens through which he had finally learned to see the world. Her love was the air he breathed. She was not a part of his life. She was the whole of it. He crossed the room to stand beside her, placing a hand on her shoulder, his gaze falling upon their son. Here was the future of the Beaumont line, born not of a contract, but of a love that had been lost and found again. He was not just an heir. He was a beginning. A testament to the profound and transformative power of truly, finally, seeing the person right in front of you. If you made it to the end of this story, thank you for listening. Tell me in the comments if Eleanor had insisted on adding a condition to their marriage contract after discovering the letter. What would you have suggested she add? We always love hearing your ideas. If you enjoyed this story, please consider liking this video and subscribing to our channel for more tales of romance and redemption. Our next story is a curious one, featuring a governess with a shadowy past, a widowed earl who has locked away his heart, and a dusty, forbidden nursery at the top of a winding staircase. They arrive here, in this little corner of the world, whenever they are ready.